Hey, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24-1395, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Jerdal Lewis Grace Appellant.
Okay, good morning, counsel. We're here on this next case. As each of you probably is aware, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, with an additional 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal. Can you both see the clock? It should be in one square of the screen on your one of the screens on your computer.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. And I can hear you both as well. So at the beginning, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself as well as the client that you represent and let us know about any pronunciations. In addition, please mute yourself when you're not speaking, but leave your video on. And if either of you has any issues with the technology at any point, please let me know. I want to make sure we take the time to resolve that so that we can hear from each of you. In addition, I would just remind everybody that we are recording these arguments and that the oral recording should be available on our website within 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Devee Axelson and I represent Appellant Jerdal Grace. The improper admission of Spriegel evidence in this case prejudiced Mr. Grace's right to a fair trial. The Supreme Court decision in Ness has made it clear that in determining Spriegel evidence must resolve a disputed fact at trial. And here, in this case, the only disputed fact at trial was whether Mr. Grace constructively possessed the pen tube in the backpack found in the car. The state claimed that the evidence was necessary to prove that Mr. Grace had not. Yet the state introduced evidence from a body cam video that Mr. Grace told an officer he'd previously been in trouble for coke. The state introduced Mr. Grace's drug test that established that he tested positive for cocaine. So the state knew going into this case that it had no problem with establishing Mr. Grace's knowledge of cocaine, yet it asked to introduce the Spriegel evidence based on that, on those reasons. The Stegen case, which is a decision from this court, albeit unpublished, but involves this same exact county and the same exact prosecutor, where this prosecutor, again, asked to just admit prior drug offenses in order to establish what without the disputed fact at issue, was propensity evidence that my client uses and possesses drugs. And in Stegen, the court rejected the reasons provided by the state, which I argued that this court should also reject those reasons. And the reason is because the 2018 conviction for Mr. Grace involved an entirely different drug. It involved methamphetamine and not cocaine. And the state made an argument in their closing argument, essentially arguing propensity that it established that that my client possesses drugs in a backpack, which again is the most commonly used item in the world for carrying anything. Additionally, there was a 2021 case a straw, which again is different from what the evidence was in this case. In our case, it involves a pen tube, and Mr. Bueller in his brief attempts to blend these two together by putting a parent or putting them together throughout the brief, even though none of the witnesses testified that this was a straw. They all testified that it was a pen tube, which again is something, both things could be used to ingest cocaine, but they are not the exact same item. And again, because this doesn't resolve a disputed issue of fact at trial, the only use for this evidence is propensity. And that's where we get to the prejudice prong of this case. And in Stegen, actually, there was a witness who went in and purchased the drugs from Mr. Stegen and testified that he had purchased methamphetamine from Mr. Stegen. So we had direct evidence in that case. Yet the court found, because of the improper admission of the Spriegel evidence in Stegen, that the prejudice was so great that it reversed Mr. Stegan's conviction. Here we have a case involving constructive possession, and we have circumstantial evidence to establish Mr. Grace's potential possession of the bag. So we have case than we had in Stegan regarding Mr. Grace's guilt than there was in Stegan. Moving on, I want to address the sentence in this case. And I do understand the burden that's ahead of me when we are talking about the imposition of a presumptive sentence. But I think this court needs to look at, this court represents the state of Minnesota, and we look at cases from, and this court looks at cases from all across the state. Polk County clearly is doing something different from the rest of the state. You look at the beginning of this case, and you look at the fact that the officer saw this car pull into this parking lot, watched it for 10 minutes. Clearly, he saw the officer would have seen the sticker on the back windshield and the item from the rear view mirror. He had a reasonable suspicion at that point to pull this car over at any point. Yet the officer waited for the driver of this vehicle to drive around past a park, past a school, and then waited until after that was completed before he pulled this person over. And the reason the officer would do that is because he knows that this fifth degree controlled substance crime, if the officer finds drugs, is going to be elevated to a third degree level. And so you have that component of this case. You also have the fact that this is the most de minimis violation that you could have of possessing drugs in a park or a school. One, it is a residual amount of drugs that was found on this pen tube. You have the fact that Mr. Grace was not driving the car. That he is merely a passenger in this car when the car drives through the park, past the park, and past the school. Mr. Grace's feet never step into either of those places, and essentially it violates the plain language of the statute, but it does not violate the what is actually the concern that Mr. Bueller improperly testified to in closing argument on facts and not in evidence regarding why the legislature created this crime. So I do think this is a rare case where this court should reverse the sentence and remand this back down to the district court to impose a sentence that would be a durational departure. And I think if you look at Mr. Grace's criminal history score, it's a criminal history score of 5, and durational departure for criminal history score 5 for a fifth degree controlled substance, which is really what this offense is, would be 19 months stayed. And I think that this court should order the district court to impose that in this case because of the unique facts of this case that are so different from the typical case this court sees.
Well, I think you've made a decent argument. I think that the district court could have departed. But I'm struggling with the argument that you have to make on appeal to succeed, which is the district court must have departed. The district court must have exercised its discretion in a way that moved away from the presumptive sentence. I'd like you to address that in particular because that's the concern I have with your argument.
I understand that concern, and I think that in a number one, this is not an argument that I commonly raise in my 22 years of working this office. It is rare that I make any challenge to a presumptive sentence. I can only remember one other instance in 22 years of making this challenge. I think all the equities and all the arguments essentially are on the side of an abuse of discretion here, based on, again, the de minimis violation of the statute, the fact that that of the officer's decision to not pull this person over earlier in the case. I also think that the way that Polk County is prosecuting and charging these cases compared to the rest of the state, which is all brought up in the district court's memo, that that this court has the ability to see injustice and to answer to injustice. And there is an injustice in this case when you take the small amount of drugs that are possessed, the fact that my client never steps foot into a park, and you look at the way Polk County is aggressively going After these type of cases, at least in comparison to the entire state, the fact that they have double the convictions of the next closest county, which is out of Rochester, which again, I don't know the exact numbers, but is clearly a much bigger geographic area and has way more people in it than Polk County does. So I do think that this is the rare case where all the merit and all the equities go towards my client in the fact that the presumptive sentence here is simply an abuse of discretion by the judge.
Why wouldn't a decision in your favor appear instead? I'm not, I mean, I'm just hypothetically, why wouldn't it appear instead that we are impugning a particular county's prosecutorial discretionary decisions?
Well, I think because of all the other factors here, because of the, again, I don't want to keep sounding like a broken record, but again, because of the de minimis that this court also can look at, this Massachusetts case that has a very similar fact pattern where that court, the Supreme Court in Massachusetts, did change the result in that case, although I don't think it was specifically regarding the sentence. I think it was regarding the conviction. But I think that the court can look at that. It can look at the footnote in Benefield that talks about the difference between actually being in a park or being in a at a school versus possessing. I didn't mention this earlier, but also the time of night. Again, we're talking about a stop that happens at 10:30 at night, and that also goes into the factor here. I think again, I'm not saying that in every single case this court needs to reverse Polk County's prosecutorial discretion and how they want to charge cases. But I think this is the unique and rare case where this court should step in and tell Polk County that in the most de minimis of cases, you are not going to be able to get a, you're going to be able to get a conviction for this, but the sentence is not going to be commensurate with that conviction based on the conduct that my client was convicted of and that the facts support.
Can you direct us, Mr. Axelson, to any other Minnesota authority for the type of relief you are seeking here with respect to the sentence, given that it was a presumptive sentence that was imposed?
No, it obviously is a rare occasion. I know there are, one or two examples from this court, both against my clients and for my clients, where the court is willing to step in and say that the presumptive sentence is incorrect. And I know that there is not a breadth of cases that support my decision, but I think that you can take from the Benefield footnote that the Supreme Court has essentially said that this is the fact situation for my case is different than the typical case. And I think you can look again to other jurisdictions. I know they're not binding, but I think that the analysis in the Massachusetts case is helpful in figuring out why this is going to be one of the unique cases where you should step in and say that the presumptive sentence is just not fair and not just in this matter. I do want to, it looks like I have a couple of minutes. I do want to just briefly address, I know that there's not objections to a lot of, the other matters that are in this case. And I think, based on, as I explained in my reply brief, that Mr. Bueller has an obligation to not to introduce evidence that's improper. I think that the Birch case specifically addresses probation under the Spriegel analysis, and I would agree that they did not reverse in that case, but again, they address the introduction of probation under the Spriegel analysis. Here we're not, it's not just a mere mention of probation like there was in Birch. We have documents and things being read into the record, essentially, that the prosecutor here did everything they could to attack Mr. Grace's character and to sully Mr. Grace's character to the jury here, and they got the conviction that they wanted based on their ability to introduce all these things. I think the court also needs to look at the closing argument, which is totally improper. Prosecutors are told that they're not supposed to bring up sentencing and the results, and here the prosecutor specifically told the jury that the presence of the school zone leads to additional punishment. And that's plain error for the prosecutor to say that. And no, I don't have to find a case that specifically where the same prosecutor or any prosecutor makes these silly arguments that are not permitted and that are outside the facts of the record. I established plain error by saying that the prosecutor introduced facts that were not in evidence. And I established plain error by showing that the prosecutor was referencing punishment, which he's not permitted to do. So unless the court has additional questions, I would yield my remaining minute. I would ask again the court to reverse. I think it can reverse solely based on the Spriegel evidence if it doesn't want to get into the unobjected cases based on Stegan. And again, this is the rare case where if the court does affirm Mr. Grace's conviction, that Mr. Grace is deserving of a sentence less than the presumptive sentence based on the facts of this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Axelson. So we will be turning to counsel for respondent, Mr. Bueller. Just a reminder to please introduce yourself and the name of your client at the beginning. The clock is reset and you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Bueller. I am the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this criminal appeal. And at the outset, I want to thank you for the accommodation to appear via Zoom given my current physical problems. I want to start with where counsel left off, and that is this issue of prosecutorial misconduct. Because in his reply brief, he selectively quotes from the Minnesota Supreme Court in Fields. And I want to make sure that the court understands the full quote from the Supreme Court, what it says, attempting to elicit or actually eliciting clearly inadmissible evidence may constitute misconduct. Not always, it may. Because counsel's argument essentially is that anything that he disagrees with that a prosecutor does at trial automatically becomes misconduct, and therefore that the modified plain error standard review would apply. Now, this isn't a case in which I violated court order in the very same case that a judge told me not to introduce evidence. And more importantly, the context in which this trial occurred, I think, points out the folly of counsel's argument, especially when you look at the probationary evidence. Now, I would note that counsel cites to State versus Birch, case that I actually tried. That's a case where I actually called the probation agent's officer to testify at trial about where he resided, which was a crucial element in proving constructive possession. This court never found error. It just simply went off and said, no, it actually noted the relevance of the evidence, but went off on the substantial, the prong of substantial effect on the defendant's rights. It didn't find any, which is consistent with the Minnesota Supreme Court's longstanding practice that you can go off on any error of plain error. So to say that Birch stands for the unequivocal proposition that any evidence regarding probation is clearly inadmissible in any case is absurd. And of course, it is contradicted by cases such as the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Bugs, this court's decisions in Johnson and Saleem that I cited in my brief. But the way this trial played out, I disclosed all the evidence ahead of time, actually filed a memorandum of law with regard to the admissibility of the crimes evidence, specifically noted in that memorandum that the defendant was on probation for the two convictions, two of his nine drug-related convictions that I was attempting to introduce evidence on. I pre-marked my exhibits. I made them available to defense counsel before trial. And Mr. Goodmanson, who's probably the most experienced assistant public defender in Northwest Minnesota, reviewed those exhibits before trial, specifically stated he had no objection to them. I provided an exhibit list to the court as well as an exhibit list to Mr. Goodmanson, so everybody knew exactly what it was that was coming in at trial. Despite that, there was no evidence or no objection by Mr. Goodmanson to the form of these exhibits. He did object before trial as to relevance and prejudice. Those are separate issues. The court also didn't intervene sua sponte. Despite all of that, counsel's argument is that I've committed misconduct. Now, I've been a prosecutor for more than 30 years, and I take that allegation seriously. If I've committed misconduct, that means I have stepped over the bounds of any acceptable behavior in court, and that I should be referred to the PR board for it. Now, there's a distinction between error and misconduct that this court has recognized, as well as the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court and this court both have said errors occur all the time during the course of trials. That's a far cry from misconduct. So the one problem I have with counsel's argument is essentially for me to avoid committing what he calls misconduct in the future, I would have to script out my testimony for all of my witnesses and provide it to the court as well as defense counsel, make sure that they don't have any objections. And I do know that according to counsel, by pre-marking my exhibits, making them available to counsel, and counsel saying as an objection to it isn't enough, I would then have to force the district court to review those exhibits and say, sua sponte, does the court have any objection to those exhibits before I introduce them? So apparently I'm supposed to do a mini trial before the trial to avoid being accused of misconduct. I think that's
absurd. Can I turn your attention to, so we don't use all the time on prosecutorial misconduct, but relatedly, the charging decision in this case, I'll just be frank with you, seems to be, it's obviously there's prosecutorial discretion in deciding what to charge. It seems unusual in this case, in my view, I'll just tell you, to charge what was charged in light of the corporal's decision to make the stop when the stop was made. Can you address what seems to be, or what at least might be implied in the circumstances, that there was an intent to exaggerate the nature of the offense by following the vehicle until it passed into prohibited zones before making the stop, knowing the vehicle was coming from a place where marijuana was allegedly known to be sold?
Well, first of all, I would note that that argument's never been made before the district court. There was never any allegation that the officer involved in this case had some improper motive. There was no challenge to the stop. There was never
I'm not saying the motive was improper. The motive would seem to be fair law enforcement. A person who's possessing drugs in the school zone, you get a more serious charge. There was the offense. There's no dispute in the record, is there, about the timing of the visual observation of the obstructed view and the timing of the stop? Is there any dispute in the record about that?
No, Your Honor, it's all actually on video. I mean, you can't see the obstructed view from the initial part of the video because the camera doesn't kick on until shortly before the stop, but there's no dispute about that. But that's assuming that an officer is legally required to stop somebody immediately. That means we'd be litigating the little traffic.
No, as I said, I want to make it clear. As I said, maybe it's good law enforcement to try to get the most serious charge possible by waiting until there's a more serious violation. But the violation of having drugs in a school zone, in a prohibited zone, when you're just driving past at night, when there are no students around, and the charge is based upon what's in the backpack, I'll just tell you, it strikes me as, even if it's creative, good law enforcement to find the most significant charge possible, I know the charge hasn't been made about prosecutorial discretion and charging at this level, but when it comes down to it, there may be some consequence at the sentencing. And I just want to give you an opportunity to discuss all of that in context, whether you think this is a reasonable use of a reasonable approach prosecutorially, and as it regards the sentence in particular to the arguments that were raised here.
Well, Judge, I certainly do, because you may not be aware of this, but I was actually the prosecutor who tried the Benefield case. And I was the prosecutor who handled not only the trial, but as well as the appeal in the Stegen case from 2012. Those were both my cases. In the Benefield case, it occurred at night. The drugs weren't found until the defendant had been arrested at the police department. Minnesota Supreme Court affirmed his conviction, found no problem with the charge. Stegen was a defendant who drove through a park and school zone in East Grand Forks. Sentencing issue wasn't raised, but I would note that, to quote counsel, his feet never touched the ground in a park or school zone. This court found that there was no basis for distinguishing Benefield on those facts. I'll admit, I mean, we've taken an aggressive approach of prosecuting drug offenders in Polk County, and I'm not going to apologize for that. We have historically taken a very aggressive view on prosecuting drug dealers. So I've got a fentanyl case that's in front of the
Minnesota Supreme Court. I appreciate that. It's not on the record. I'm not going to ask you to speak to it on the record. I'll just tell you that if it is so that prosecutors in your office are encouraging law enforcement to wait to make stops until after a person drives by a school at night so you get a more significant charge, I'll just tell you, not speaking for the court, just speaking for myself, I think that's extraordinary. I
Yeah.
hope that's not the case. I'm not asking you to comment on whether it is the case. I'm just going to say it so.
It is not the case, Your Honor, and I will state that unequivocally. We take the cases as they come, and the officer in this case, Your Honor, is a long experienced officer. He testified in court. If there was any reason for impugning his integrity, I think Judge Remick would have taken that into account at the time.
No, I'm not saying it's, I don't even know if it would be a basis to impugn his integrity. I think good law enforcement would say, let's get the most serious charge possible. Let's give him enough rope. That's what cops do. But anyway, I don't want to spend all of your time on this issue. There are other issues.
But I do want to address part of this issue, Your Honor, and that is going back to the fact that there is no case in the state of Minnesota, at least none that I'm aware of, published or unpublished, where either this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court has reversed a district court's refusal to depart on a similar ground to this. In fact, I'm not even aware, and counsel does not cite any case which would find this to be a de minimis offense, that he, as he calls it. Let's keep in mind the controlled substance crime, the third degree offense, there is no quantity element involved in it. It is one or more mixtures containing methamphetamine. If we can't depart upwards based upon quantity, which is Minnesota Supreme Court said, how do we depart downward based upon a statute that doesn't require a minimum quantity? Or are we going to do a variation between the trace amount to the 3 grams, which would be a separate third degree, and then anywhere in there?
Well, in fairness, Mr. Axelman, as I understood the argument, it wasn't just the fact this was a trace amount. It was the time of night. It was the allotted time between the officers observing a violation and the officer making the decision to stop, and the location of the drugs within a backpack in the car. I think it was a combination of things, in fairness to the argument.
And I acknowledge that, Your Honor. I just would note that part of the issue is, how do you define this as being a less serious offense, is what she's attempting to do, setting aside the disagreement with prosecutorial discretion, because I disagree that a disagreement with the prosecutor's charging discretion is a basis for a sentencing departure. Minnesota Supreme Court essentially rejected that back in Soto in 1997. This court rejected it in Perlberg. Because if you accept that argument, then the uniformity of the sentencing guidelines goes out the window now, because then everybody would be entitled to a departure in Polk County. We then have to find what is the one county in the state of Minnesota that sets the bare minimum for prosecution and then sentence down to that. That would take the uniformity and proportionality of the sentencing guidelines, which are based upon the offense of conviction, as the guidelines themselves say, not charging practices.
And one more question on this subject of sentencing. I don't know. I haven't looked at the statistics. What can you tell us, or how do you address Mr. Axelson's argument that your county is an outlier with regard to this particular type of charge?
We are, Your Honor. I mean, I don't make any dispute about that. The statistics are in the record. We charge these cases more than anybody else does. I started this when I prosecuted the Benefield case in Olmsted County. We clearly do. But there's never been anybody who has found an abuse of discretion in our charging. We've actually had equal protection challenges raised to our charging discretion at the district court.
No, I'm not talking about equal protection. I'm not talking about abuse of discretion in charging. I'm talking about in the context of whether this is the offense in this case at this level was atypically less serious than other charges. And if I'm looking at it, if we look at it from a statewide perspective, if Polk County is the only county charging these offenses at this level under circumstances like this, is that enough to support a downward departure? And if it is it enough to require a reversal for failure to enforce or failure to depart?
All I can say, Your Honor, is that this court has said sentencing statistics by themselves in cases like Perlberg and a host of unpublished opinions say that's not a basis for departure because other counties depart. We're not even talking departure rates here because counsel doesn't rely upon sentencing statistics. He relies on charging decisions, charging statistics, conviction statistics. Those say nothing about the appropriateness of a sentence because the sentence is supposed to be based upon the offense the defendant is convicted of.
Can I switch terms? Can we go to a quick thing before your time is up, Mr. Bueller? Is that all right with you, Judge Ross?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to occupy the
okay.
time of this issue.
I just want to go back to the evidence of probation violation. I mean, you brought a Spriegel motion on many pieces of evidence, Mr. Buehler, but they did not include evidence of the probation violations. Am I correct?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree. If you look at my memorandum that I filed on the pretrial memorandum, it specifically stated the two convictions. I was only introducing evidence for the two convictions, which were both that ones that he discussed in his post-arrest interview and he attempted to minimize. Both of those, I acknowledged, they were stated in my memorandum, he was actually on probation for those offenses at that time. So it was clearly in my memorandum of law. It wasn't addressed as a separate issue, though, and frankly, counsel doesn't cite to any case that says if otherwise admissible evidence, other crimes evidence comes in, that the fact the defendant is still on probation for that constitutes a separate violation of Rule 404B. And to just follow up on your question, though, I do want to take exception with one issue that counsel raised when he says that the only issue in this case was whether he knew the cocaine was in the backpack. The defendant did not stipulate to anything in this case. I had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his possession of cocaine was unlawful, that he knew what cocaine was, and that his possession was knowing and intentional. Those were issues that were in this case from the very beginning and remained throughout the case. State versus Florine, State versus Harris make that clear. And cases like State versus Boykin and State versus Coleman from this court recently make clear that other crimes evidence is relevant to prove those types of facts when in fact they are an issue. I see I'm out of time here. If there aren't any questions, I just want to thank you, Your Honors, for allowing me to appear today.
Hey, thank you so much. I don't see any further questions. So at this time, we will turn back to counsel for appellant for rebuttal. There are 5 minutes on the clock. Mr. Axelson, you may begin when you are ready.
Again, I'll just jump into the issue that he was just finishing up on. Mr. Buehler fails again to explain how he didn't already have evidence of my client's knowledge of cocaine. He introduced the fact that my client had cocaine in his system. He also introduced that my client said to the officer, one of the first things he said was that he had been in trouble for coke before. So he did not have an issue in his trial. There was not a disputed issue in his trial about whether my client knows what cocaine is. He had that evidence. He introduced that evidence, and he still then asked for Spriegel evidence to reprove that same point. At that point, it becomes propensity. This court has an easy path to reversal in this case. It can just follow the Stegen decision. There are two prior offenses that are not similar that are introduced for propensity. Mr. Buehler argues propensity arguments in his closing argument, as put in my brief regarding those two prior convictions. And that is the path to reversing in this case. So if this court is not moved by the non-objected to mistakes by Mr. Goodmanson, again, him not agreeing to that. Mr. Goodmanson also didn't object when Mr. Buehler read Spriegel into evidence, which there's many cases from this court that say that that's improper too. Now, again, I didn't raise that in this case and we're not focusing on that, but Mr. Goodmanson does not know what he's doing. Mr. Buehler can say that he's been there for a long time. There are numerous mistakes that he makes. Mr. Buehler, again, referring to the fact that my client was on probation, he does not make a coherent argument. He does not rely on cases in his memo prior to trial saying that the probation is relevant. And again, I didn't pick and choose what I disputed about things that Mr. Buehler introduced in this trial. I relied on cases. Mr. Buehler, again, asked for a consciousness of guilt instruction. That's black letter law from the Supreme Court that's an improper argument. Did Mr. Goodmanson agree to that? Probably, but it's not something that Mr. Buehler should have ever put forward. And he specifically says in his memo that it's improper. And again, in his closing argument, he relies on that consciousness of guilt instruction, and he makes an argument that my client's guilty. How many other cases does this court see from other counties in this state where it gets introduced that a client no-shows for a pretrial hearing and that there's a consciousness of guilt argument? Probably none. You probably have never seen that argued in any other case. Mr. Buehler had to rely on a case from 1934 for that proposition. So I just ask that this court follow Stegen. I know it's an unpublished case, but it's very similar facts. And Stegan involved direct evidence as opposed to circumstantial evidence. This court doesn't need to address the other issues in this case if it doesn't want to. But Stegan provides this court the path to victory for my client where he gets a new trial. And that's what I'm asking for in this case. And the alternative, if the court doesn't grant a new trial, I think this is the rare case. I think Judge Ross got into some of the reasons why this is the rare case and that Mr. Bueller's prosecutorial discretion in this case needs to be reined in. So unless the court has additional questions, I would concede the rest of my time.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you so much. To both counsel, we appreciate the briefing as well as argument here today. The case is submitted and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.